You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, sponsored by SoundRing. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
Today's show is brought to you by Texture. Declutter your coffee table and access all of your favorite magazines right on your phone or tablet. To get your all-access pass to the world's most popular magazine titles, please visit texture.com/breakitdown.
Daddy, can you break it down?
Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down.
Hey guys, welcome to the show. Super pumped today. This is really exciting for me. I love this episode. It's my favorite thing I've done to date, really. And it's because I've got to do some real learning on air here, people. There's something I realized is, since I have an audience, you guys, then there's people that are willing to talk to me that are smart and have opinions and know stuff and have experiences. And so I can use that to just explore stuff. So what I wanted to explore today is the notion of terrorism and radical Islam and Syria and refugees. And as some of you guys know, I'm not a political guy at all. And I don't know much about this stuff. I never thought about it even too much, really. And we were on the road a few weeks ago, and there was the bombings and terrorists in Paris, the attacks there, and then come to find out it was in a rock club, in a small room, the same kind of place we play. We've been to France, we've been all over Europe, and it kind of hit home. And then come to find out even more, Under Oath's European merch guy, Nick, was doing merch that night for Eagles of Death Metal. And unfortunately, I don't know if you know this or not, but he was killed. He was murdered by terrorists. So now I'm really thinking about this stuff. I got to deal with it. I got to think about it all of a sudden. Something that I thought was maybe far off or political, now it's kind of real. And then, of course, I see everything on social media and what people are saying, and some of it seems so crazy, and some of it seems so mean, and some of it seems so fruity. I don't know how to cut through it. So I try to use my logic and brain and stuff, but I'm not coming up with any good answers. So here we go. I get to talk to people that do know stuff and do have opinions. And the first one is Jeffrey Atticott. He is a terrorism law professor. He's a retired military guy, very accomplished, very knowledgeable. He appears on Fox News and stuff like that very often. He's an expert, has a book out, and he's at St. Mary's College in San Antonio, Texas. So I talked to him to get some background on what exactly is this situation. What is terrorism? What is going on in Syria? Then I talked to a guy named Jason Stapleton, who is a pretty really smart guy who has a show called the Jason Stapleton Program. He's a libertarian guy. He values liberty, and he has some really interesting thoughts on what our responsibilities are as people, as Americans, and what is the government's responsibility. And then I talked to my buddy Science Mike and wanted to discuss fear and how humans respond and what's going on the internet and why do we react these ways that we do to stuff like this. And then I talked to Chris Dudley from Under Oath, who was good friends with and knew the merch guy, Nick, who was killed by terrorists. And so that one's really interesting, too. So that's the map of what I'm going to talk to today, and I hope it'll color your point of view. Some of the stuff these guys say is really interesting. Some of it's brilliant, and some of it sounds crazy to me, and I think it will to you. But like I said, I'm jazzed because I'm genuinely learning in real time, having conversations on the air. So to me, this is tremendous. I hope you guys enjoy this format. I think I could do it for a lot of different topics or subjects, really, that I think would be fun to explore multiple points of view on. Now, I'm asking you guys, please, at this point, if you haven't, leave me a review on iTunes. Just go there, leave some stars, whatever you think it's worth, write a note. That helps me out. Please go to my website, and anytime you shop on Amazon, which is a great place to shop, if you click through the link from my website, have that bookmarked, then I will get some points on that. I'll get a couple of bucks for whatever it is that you're buying or spending. So thank you, everybody, for doing that thus far. And seriously, thank you so much to the people that have decided to actually contribute money and pay for this podcast. That is actually what I wish everybody would do, but I'm totally cool if you don't. But please go to my website, click the contribute button, and maybe pay a few bucks an episode so that I can do stuff like this. I'd love to make more episodes, explore more subjects, and do more of this stuff. And the more gravity that this show gets, the more time I will for sure clear out inevitably and spend on it. And I really am excited. This is my favorite thing that I do. I really enjoy it. And I hope you guys enjoy this episode as much as I do. Now, this episode is brought to you by Texture. Texture is one of my fine sponsors. I really appreciate having them on here. And so Texture is an app that gives you all access pass to the magazines that you love right on your phone or tablet. They've got hundreds of real magazines that you can just cherry pick the articles that you care about the most. And I really think real journalism and great writing is a lost art in some of the junk that's on the internet these days. Remember what it used to be like to read a magazine? Let's get back to that. Here's the best part. Texture is offering my listeners a free trial right now when you go to texture.com/breakitdown. Even better, I'll tell you what, why don't you give Texture as a gift between now and December 31st. Think about that. You get unrestricted access to the world's best magazines from back issues to the ones on newsstands today. This is a fantastic gift for you or a loved one. And I think it's really a good idea. So here, let's do an experiment. Picture this. You give this to your dad. Your dad takes his phone or his tablet. I bet he uses that. You know what? I bet he takes it to the toilet when he does his business. Picture it. Your dad on the toilet reading ESPN magazine, Road and Track, Field and Stream, whatever he's into. And he's thinking of you every time that he opens the app, every single time, once a day. What a good gift that is. You get it for your mom. I'm sure she reads Golf Digest, or your sister. She likes Glamour or Elle, or, you know, there's plenty of magazines and you like them too. So here's how you got to do. Go to texture.com/breakitdown today. And with that, we'll get straight into the episode here. We're going to first, like I said, talk to Jeffrey Atticott. What I was looking for him for, it was some background, some knowledge. So how does this work? How do we get here historically? What is terrorism? What's going on in Syria? And I got that from him and more. So check this out. Here we go. All right, so Professor Jeffrey Atticott here. I'm really glad to talk to you today because you seem to be an expert in something that I don't know too much about and very interested. You're a retired U.S. Army lieutenant colonel. You are a professor at St. Mary's. You founded the Center for Terrorism Law, and you teach about the law of war and stuff like that down there at St. Mary's. You got a book. You show up on TV as an expert on stuff like that. But let's start. Tell me about the Center for Terrorism Law. What is that?
Our Center for Terrorism Law, I founded it about 13 years ago. I'm the director. I did 20 years in the military. I was a senior advisor to all the Green Berets. So now I did it in the real world. So now I'm doing it in the academic world. Mm-hmm. And at the law school here in San Antonio, Texas, that's what we do. We look at all the legal issues and policy issues related to terrorism. And of course, it's very critical in this discussion to define the terms.
Yeah, exactly. Let's start there. What is the definition of terrorism? It sounds like it might be a little bit ambiguous.
Exactly. There is no international definition of terrorism. The United Nations tried to do it a couple of times, but it's never taken off. Domestically, the federal government has, in the United States Code, several definitions of terrorism. There's just no international one.
But well, okay, what's the domestic one then?
Yeah, basically, when you boil it down, it's you use violence intentionally to target civilians in order to cause a government or a non-government agency to do something or to refrain from doing something. So it means you use violence against civilians and you have a methodology behind that. So in other words, terrorism is not random acts of violence. The person that engages with the tactic of terrorism wants to accomplish something. Mm-hmm. So when President Obama, for example, says the terrorist did it, it's non-descriptive. What does that mean? Terrorism is a tactic. You've got to understand who are the people that are using the tactic of terrorism, which is to kill civilians to cause fear.
So terrorism would include shooting up Planned Parenthood or Timothy McVeigh bombing the federal building in Oklahoma City.
It could. My latest book is called Radical Islam Why, and I spend the first couple of chapters talking about defining terrorism. And there are really four types of groups of people that use terrorism as a tactic. Mm-hmm. You have common criminals. Usually these people are on some type of instability, mentally unstable, criminal types that want to kill people just for the kicks of it. They do it as a lust pattern. Mm-hmm. Then you have right-wing extremists. Right-wing extremists are like the Timothy McVeighs. These people have a paranoia about big government. Now, all conservatives don't like big government, but these folks have a paranoia. And when they snap and they use terrorism as a tactic, they target symbols of federal authority of some sort. Mm-hmm. And then you have the largest category, which is radical Islam. By far and away, if you look at the federal prosecution since 9/11, it's not right-wing extremists, it's not left-wing extremists, it's not even criminal nut jobs, it's radical Islam. And they have attempted to kill in this country with plots that have been broken up. Well over 100 plots have been broken up. And so when radical Islamists use terror, they target civilians. And that's why when you see an attack at a marathon or at a concert or, at large population centers, that's probably going to be radical Islam because that's what they target. They want to kill as many people as they possibly can.
Okay, so there's been 100 attempted terrorist plots by radical Islam that have been broken up in the United States since 9/11.
Yeah, and here in Texas, we've had many, many plots that have been broken up, but tragically, one of them got through, and that was Major Nadal Hassan, who was a United States Army officer. He became radicalized in Virginia, and he slaughtered 13 people here at Fort Hood and wounded many more. Then you had the Boston Marathon attack. Those were two individuals motivated by radical Islam. But most of the plots we've broken up, the Lackawanna Six, the Fort Dix Six, many, many plots across the country, we've had good police work, coupled with the fact that many of the jihadists here are incompetent. They don't really have the operational security to pull off a big attack.
Okay, so is it true that the most of the people that are a threat to us are actually people that are here? They're not people overseas that are coming here. They're people that are already here and become radicalized.
Yeah, and that's a great distinction because what I call it Al-Qaeda Central or ISIS Central. That is the groups that are over there where it all comes from. When they carry off a terror attack, they're about 80% successful because they have the operational skills, the intelligence, the background to pull these things off. 9/11 cost Al-Qaeda about $1 million to execute. ISIS has billions of dollars, and they're plotting right now to launch a devastating attack here in this country, and they're much more likely to succeed because the people that are inspired by radical Islam, and there are thousands of them here in this country, they're not that sophisticated. They don't have the military skills, the operational skills to really develop a plot and to execute the plot in a meaningful fashion.
But, I mean, if they've got billions of dollars, it seems like they would have been able to accomplish a lot more. I mean, we have the Paris attacks, but it doesn't seem like they've, pulled off a bunch of major stuff like they could.
Well, they've conducted a lot of attacks around the world, but unless they hit one in the West, it doesn't really make the headlines. In Pakistan, in India, in all over the place, in Bali, they've killed lots of people. That's why the Paris attacks caused such a commotion, because if that attack in Paris would have happened, let's say, in Somalia or somewhere else, nobody would care. Mm-hmm. And yet thousands of people have been killed by Al-Qaeda in different attacks around the world. They did try an attack with some planes in 2006 to fly them from Europe to here, and that was broken up through some good police force. But Al-Qaeda's been kind of on the run. They're under the ground, and it's hard to plan offensive attacks against the West when you're just trying to stay alive.
Well, what is ISIS's goal, as you see it, as they're trying to affect foreign governments or foreign policy, Al-Qaeda and ISIS? I mean, what are they wanting to do?
ISIS is the new kid on the block. They've only been around for a couple of years, so they've been phenomenal in their success. They're above the ground, so they're planning an attack against us right now, but these attacks take about a year and a half, 2 years to carry out. Their goal is to kill you, kill me, kill everybody. They want to kill. It's like an Austin Powers movie. They want to kill everybody and take over the world. I mean, now we say, well, you can't do that, but you've got to think like they think if you're going to defeat them, and they think that they can. They think that God will come back and bless their acts of terror with even greater successes in the battlefield. And so, when I was in the military, if I was advising the ISIS, chiefs, I would say, look, fellas, let's not attack these little civilian targets because you really make people upset and we can capture more territory if we were more low-key. But see, they don't care about being low-key. They are commanded by their reading of the Quran and the holy writings which tell them to do these things, and therefore their higher commander is God himself. And so operationally, they are doing what they think God tells them to do.
So, and you think that's all the way up, not that there's just some people at the top that are wielding this religious brainwashing to accomplish some power-mongering goals or something like that. You're saying all the way up through the ranks to the top, these people believe they're engaged in a holy sanctioned thing they should be doing.
Exactly. And you know, whatever you say about ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, all these other radical groups, you've got to admire them because they will die for their cause. Not many people will die for what they believe in. Mm-hmm. These folks want to die. They embrace death because they feel if they die in jihad, because Islam is a works religion. It, generally, if you're a Muslim, you have to follow a certain moral code and taboos and rituals. When you die, you'll stand before the judgment seat of Allah, and if you're good enough, you go to heaven. If not, you go to hell. But you can bypass that if you die in jihad, and therefore they're very enthusiastic about dying, because if you die in jihad, killing the infidel, you go directly to paradise, and you get these virgins that accompany you for all eternity.
Well, still, I'm unclear on what their intent or goal is. I mean, to kill 130 people in France, or even if they could kill 1,000 in the U.S., that doesn't seem to make a dent into taking over the territory or stuff.
No, what they're trying to spark is a major war mm-hmm. between the West and themselves. They would love to see nuclear weapons or large-scale weaponry involved because they believe in their religious apocalyptic vision that God will come back and conquer the world himself once things reach a very desperate level.
Okay.
That's why, for example, you don't want the Iranians to get nuclear weapons. You don't want ISIS to get nuclear weapons because they will use them because they believe that that will be the trigger for God to return. They have a second coming type of ideology. Remember, Islam came about 500 years after Christianity, and Muhammad borrowed a lot of these concepts from the Old Testament and from the New Testament about the end times. So these folks think that they're in the end times right now. They're
well,
end times.
I mean, if that's true, that's really terrifying because that means that they think they can kill 130 or even several thousand people. They know that there's going to be retaliation. You're saying they even want that to happen.
Yeah.
And that they actually would like it if we came over and attacked them. It doesn't matter about their civilian casualties or even their own soldiers. No matter what we did to them, they wouldn't be worried about that anyway. They actually invite it.
It's a win-win because if you kill them individually, they go to heaven. Mm-hmm. And if you use enough force that would trigger the coming of Allah, then they win a second time. So
yikes.
That's how they think. And our problem with our president, he doesn't think like they think. Mm-hmm. He assumes that he can contain them and this stuff will all go away if we just kind of ignore it. It's not going away. Radical Islam is growing across the world by leaps and bounds. In fact, the jihadists in this country are coming out of their holes as never before. Why? Because they see that ISIS is successful. They're not like Al-Qaeda. ISIS doesn't hide under the ground. They got their black flag of radical Islam above the ground. They're saying, come and get us, mm-hmm. come and get us, come and get us. And they're inspiring jihadists by the thousands and tens of thousands all over the world to join them.
Well, so they want us to come get them. I mean, if that's what our enemy wants us to do, what's our strategy? Should we, I mean, does that mean we should disengage or just, you know, leave them alone, protect our borders?
Well, again, once we understand how they think, if you're asking me what would I do if I was the commander-in-chief, first of all, is it in our best national interest to respond to these people? In other words, are they a threat to us? And the answer is yes, they are a threat because they've told us we're going to come here and we want to have a headline that will say Detroit gone, New York gone. If they can acquire a weapon of mass destruction, and they'll get it, they've got the money to buy one, they're going to use it. They've already told us they're going to use it. So therefore, we have to do something about it, but we cannot do what the Obama administration wants to do, what they're doing now. They're killing bees around the beehive. Mm-hmm. We need to crush the beehive, and then the jihadists around the world will say, well, I guess God wasn't on their side after all because we've crushed them and nothing happened. So we need to deal them a devastating blow. We can do it, and then, of course, we would leave because I'm not in for long, hot showers with the Middle East. We devastate them and then get out, and that'll solve the problem.
And them is
them
who?
Is who?
In this case,
then,
I mean, the whole Middle East?
Oh, no, ISIS. We know they have a capital city of Raqqa. We know geographically where they're at. We send in everything we have. We take about 3 months. We crush them, and then we leave.
Okay, so they do have like a concerted place we could attack, a capital city. But there'd be massive collateral damage. Is that? But that's our only play in your view?
Yeah. I mean, my answer to that is it legal? The law of war allows for collateral damage. War is not a Harvard term paper. You're going to have collateral damage. We do the best job of limiting civilian casualties of any military on the face of the earth, except for maybe the Israelis. But you got to do what you got to do. The military, when we use it, we must use it in a way that is overwhelming and devastating in effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, doesn't that run the risk then? I mean, could it have the reverse effect and just radicalize a whole bunch of more Muslims and make the problem worse?
Oh, well, you're asking me, what if they pop up again in a few years somewhere else? We go back and crush them again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like changing the oil on your car. There's always going to be another war. But I guarantee you, what these people will respect is force, overwhelming force. We saw that in 2003 with the war against Saddam Hussein. When we crushed his military, the entire Middle East went quiet. The Iranians stopped their nuclear program. Mm-hmm. Gaddafi admitted that he killed those people over Lockerbie, Scotland, paid the families millions of dollars. The Syrians were shaking in their boots. So they appreciate the application of overwhelming lethal force.
So like that's more traditional or, I don't know, primitive even, like that mentality of they actually respect strength of an image and force. Like that is the thing in their culture that they respond to.
I mean, you're right. I mean, we didn't start this war. They started it with us on 9/11. But when we're at war, you identify the enemy, identify their center of gravity, and totally obliterate them. That's how you win a war. And yet this administration seems to think, again, it's a Harvard term paper. We can just kind of do onesies and twosies, these supercilious rules of engagement. The Obama surge cost us 1,000 casualties, dead and wounded, and it changed nothing. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely absurd.
Well, again, pretty scary. I haven't heard anybody ever say this stuff with this authority that directly and in a credible fashion. I'm kind of having a hard time with it because I guess my natural inclination and a lot of the circles I run in would seem to be more of a, I don't know, could we fight it with education or bettering people and their conditions? And is there something that we could do that would be less devastating or violent? But maybe that's just wishful thinking and sounds good to feel and say. What you're saying is seems to be a quite reasonable, rational point of view.
Well, I've been to Guantanamo Bay. I'm the only law professor in the country that works with the military to keep the facility open. We don't need to turn these people loose in any system of thinking whatsoever. Their negotiating position, if you ask them, hey, what do you guys want? You want some land? You want some money? What do you really want? Their answer is, we want to kill you. They don't care that you're liberal, that you're a Catholic. In fact, they've killed more Muslims than Christians or Jews. If you want to do a body count, that's how they think.
Well, do people that oppose you, do they have some point of view that you find credible? I mean, what do your opponents to this point of view say? What's their typical response?
Well, you know, people that are critical of my way of thinking, I love to debate them because I intellectually destroy them. They simply emote and they say, oh, that's just horrible. And can't we just take a Coca-Cola? That's not reality, my friend. Everybody likes to eat steak, but they hate to think that there's, you know, men with lots of hair on their back killing animals in a slaughterhouse to provide that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this is reality.
Okay, well, let's jump over to Syria and talk about that. Can you give a brief background of how it got the way it is, or what is the situation here that people are needing to escape?
Yeah, well, Syria, of course, is ruled by a dictator by the name of Assad. His father was a dictator. Every country in the Middle East is run by a dictator. Some are more benign than others. Somehow, the West, including the Obama administration, they got up on their high horse and they said Assad must go. Why? I mean, Assad has not attacked us. He hasn't threatened to attack the United States. And we should learn from history that when you replace one bad guy, generally it's worse than in the first instance. When the Shah was deposed, the Ayatollah came in, far worse than the Shah. So I'm not one of these that says, we've got to get rid of Assad. Why? Oh, he's a bad guy. They're all bad guys. I mean, the question is, are they attacking the United States? And if the answer is no, well, that's the way it goes. But right now, we've got able-bodied males that are all over the Middle East. Many of them are masquerading as Syrians. Most of these so-called refugees are in their 20s. They're able-bodied males, and they're fleeing for a better life. Now, I don't blame people for wanting to get out of their country to come to this country. But they want to infect us with the virus of Sharia law. Sharia law is incompatible with Anglo-Saxon law. It's incompatible.
They who? The refugees?
Well, X number of the refugees. Yeah, absolutely. They have no frame of reference for the way we look at the world.
Okay, but in this Syrian thing specifically, what is going on? What is the crisis there specifically that makes them need to flee?
Well, because they see that we're suckers. They see, well, you're going to give me free food, a free house, a free check every month. Who wouldn't come? If you build it, they will come. And that applies to any people.
Well, I mean, that's I don't understand that, because the whole Middle East certainly is full of people who, and every country that would want to take a handout, as you put it, and stuff like that. But what is making us sensitive to the Syrian crisis? There's something going on.
Yeah, there's a war. And therefore, somehow the do-gooders think there's a war and we've got to take care of the refugees. No, you don't. I'll tell you what, I'll be fair. I will take as many Syrian refugees into this country as, say, Saudi Arabia does, because that's a Muslim country. They're brothers, right? Guess how many Saudi Arabia's taken?
Zero.
Zero. Not a single one. And so we have no obligation to take these people into our country. No European country has an obligation. Oh, but they're suffering. Oh, well, you know, that's life. What I would tell these 20-year-olds, get a gun and do what my great-great-granddaddy did when you don't like things, and fight them. That's what we did to the British. Fight for your independence. These people won't even fight for their own country, their own independence. Why in the world would a country, a Western democracy, take them in? They don't think like we think. And so there's no obligation for us to take any of these people in.
Well, I mean, that's a really broad brush that everybody in the country, I mean, that they includes women, children, helpless people, people afflicted, oppressed, people that believe probably similar to the way you do. And if it feels like you have no sympathy to those people at all.
I'm as sympathetic to them as the Saudis are. A very wealthy nation right there, next door neighbors. They're Muslims. They're all Muslims. I'm as sympathetic as they are. How about that?
Well, I mean, you seem to not have very high regard for them and their morals, so I don't know it's totally fair to compare yourself to them, but what about us as humanitarian agents?
We have no responsibility. A country has the right to maintain borders. America is a homeland for Americans. Mm-hmm. We have the right to screen people that come into this country. Too long we've had an immigration policy that opens the door to people that cannot contribute to our country. My policy would be I will let people in here that can contribute. The fact that other countries around the world are basket cases, and there's a lot of countries that fall into that category, do what my ancestors did, embrace the concept of capitalism, pick up your gun, and fight for your own freedom. I'm under no obligation to open our doors at all, and I see no reason why we should.
Well, I can understand that, I suppose, politically or theoretically, but what about individually? If you were face to face with these people, if you acknowledged them as people and saw them, what would be your hope or care or advice for the individuals?
My advice is get a gun and get a job. I've seen these people. I've been to almost every country in the world. I've seen poverty you can't even imagine in Africa and Haiti. I feel sorry for them, but that's life.
Well, so you do feel sorry for them, but you have to separate them from Americans.
Yeah,
like there's different, like you have to draw the line somewhere. So you are going to care about Americans and stuff like that, but you're going to have to separate these people and say, I have to disregard them.
I'm a nationalist. I mean, what's in it for our country is my first question. If there's nothing in it for our country, oh, well, again, my advice to these people is get your guns and fight for your freedom. That's how we were.
I mean, you live in San Antonio, right? So just, I mean, right across your border, you know that there's terrible things and some bad conditions. And if you are aware of it and see it right in your view, then how does that affect you personally? I mean, how can you maintain such an academic stance? Does your heart not go out to the people in that way?
Well, it's not my problem. You're from Mexico. Why am I on a guilt trip because people have it hard around the rest of the world? I'm sorry. I'm not going to feel guilty for other people. I want to take care of my own first. Mm-hmm. I would encourage other people. I'll tell them how our country became so great. You can do it too. So mm-hmm. I'm all about assisting other people. I'll give them a hand up, but I'm not going to give them a hand out. Mm-hmm. I want people that can contribute to the prosperity of America, not people that will drag us down. Well, we got to educate, feed, clothe, house. No, I'm sorry. Stay in your own country. If you love your own country, then fight for your own country. That's what we did.
Okay. So the problem here then is radical Islam. Would you name it as such, or do you think the problem that we have is, in fact, the Middle East?
Well, you know, as Harry Truman, one of our presidents, said, they said, what's your opinion of history? He said, it's just one damn thing after the other. I mean, we're not going to solve the problems of mankind. They're going to continue until I'm a Christian, until, of course, the second coming. So right here in the here and now, life is the world's a very dangerous place. And I feel for my fellow humans that are struggling, but my advice to them is, you know, you're going to have to fight for your freedom, fella. That's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. So if we have an obligation, like in Vietnam, where we, you know, pulled out of South Vietnam, we had an obligation to our allies that fought with us to bring them into this country, I'm all for that. We have no obligation to the Syrians. The Middle East is awash. It's a mess. There's all sorts of problems. There always will be problems. I think our greatest thing to do is to have energy independence so we don't have to rely on the oil over there. And therefore, we can let them stew in their own stew. They can figure out their own destiny. And it's in our interest to have energy independence so we don't have to be involved with those countries over there. We don't have to take their oil. We can take the own energy resources we have here.
Okay, so, you know, solar, electric stuff.
No, I don't care about solar. That's a pipe dream. I care about oil, a dollar a gallon, and we have enough oil here to last for hundreds and hundreds of years. And if we have a bird that gets oil on its wings, oh, well, we clean it up and move on to the next one.
Okay, well, this is difficult. I mean, it's quite interesting, in fact. I mean, I have to really respect the vast amounts of knowledge that you have and the experience. It's on orders of magnitude more than I do. Some of it's really difficult and scary, and it feels, I don't know if it feels overly pragmatic or ideological or academic. I'm not exactly sure how to describe it, but it's but I know it can't be as simple as everybody be nice, let's just be nice, take care of everybody, and everything is going to work out. I understand that those realities are very much there. So I have to really consider the points of view that you have. It means something to me, and I wanted to talk to some other people too, because like I said, I feel like most other people out there are not too knowledgeable, but the subject is tough.
All you hear is, let's drink a Coca-Cola and embrace peace and let everybody in. It's a bunch of nonsense.
Well, I really appreciate your point of view and willingness to, you know, come on here and share it. I know you're trying to do the best thing that you think is the right thing to do, and some really good information too.
I would do one self plug. I've got a new book out called Radical Islam Why. You can get it on Amazon. Everything I've said is in there, heavily footnoted with facts, figures, great Christmas gift. You know, somebody wants one signed, just have Google me and send me an email. I'll be happy to do that as well.
And you'll sign it for them. So, and you're doing TV appearances, Fox News and stuff.
Yeah, on the 8th and 9th of December, as soon as I get back from Communist China, which I'm going over there tomorrow, on Tuesday, Fox News is set me up for a book signing. So, again, you can Google the book, and you know, it doesn't pull any punches, but again, I try to be as objective as I possibly can.
All right. Well, good luck with your book. Jeffrey Atticott's book is called Radical Islam Why. Jeffrey, thank you a ton. I hope you have a good holiday and everything else.
My pleasure. Same to you.
Appreciate it. All right. And then I hope you enjoyed that with Jeffrey Atticott. Again, I was looking for some background information and stats and to really get a kind of a factual grip on it. The next guy I found that I wanted to talk to after that is a guy who has some thoughts on policy and liberty and government involvement. Jason is a former force reconnaissance Marine, spent a lot of time deployed with boots on the ground in the Middle East. So he's got a lot of firsthand perspective over there, which I think is valuable. He does a podcast now, which I stumbled onto, and he talks about liberty and libertarian principles there. And I listened to a couple of the episodes and really liked a lot of what he had to say. So I just hit him up, emailed him, told him who I was and who you guys, my listeners, are. And sure enough, was able to talk to him straight away later that day. So here we go with Jason Stapleton. Specifically, what I wanted to get into is the piece you wrote. You wrote it and then read it on your show, and it was on the one about the attacks on Paris.
That's the- yeah. It was a piece I wrote about trying to calm the waters after mm-hmm. the attacks, because I knew there was going to be a massive call to arms, mm-hmm. And similar to what happened after September 11th, and I wanted to try and cut off a lot of the neoconservative talk that I was hearing already, the rumblings about how we needed to get more involved in the foreign wars, and mm-hmm. so I wrote that piece from as one military man writing about my experiences overseas and hopefully trying to convince some people that. It may be worthwhile to at least look at some other options before we start committing more young men to combat.
Yeah, so even as a military guy, one might expect that with the boots on the ground experience that you might be pro military action and stuff like that. And I was looking for somebody that I considered conservative to try to hold up this point of view, because I know plenty of liberal-minded people that are all about peace and accepting refugees. Like, that point's actually kind of really easy to see, and maybe one that I naturally gravitate toward versus take over, go to war, don't allow them, that kind of thing. And so for somebody that's educated, military background, and seem somewhat conservative, at least I would say, I don't know if that's the proper description or not, for you to say we should take not action, we should calm the waters, not do that, I thought stuck out. So that's what I wanted to ask about. The first thing you were saying there is that that stood out to me in that piece was you said that we're fighting an idea. It's not really a concerted enemy that's out there. It's really just an idea that we're fighting. And how do you fight an idea?
No, I'm not suggesting that you can't fight an idea. I'm suggesting that you don't win the war. And what I mean by an idea is that the war we're fighting right now against the idea of radical Islam, if that's the way you want to frame it, and I think that's a fair way to frame it, is that you don't fight that idea with bombs or bullets, because what you do is you create and foster even more mm-hmm. hatred the more bombs that you drop and the more war you engage in, the more people you displace. The vast majority of people in the Middle East are not radical terrorists, and what you find is that even what you're doing by engaging in war in the Middle East is you are converting people who otherwise would be unsympathetic to a message of hate from foreign countries like outside of the Middle East, like Paris and in Italy and in the United States, because of all of the collateral damage that you cause in a war like that.
Yeah, takes people that are sitting on the fence and then makes them go, I guess these people are right, these radical people.
At least you become more sympathetic and you get mm-hmm. to a point where you just say, well, hey, I have to do something because of this evil, oppressive, U.S. military or foreign governments that keep injecting themselves into matters that they shouldn't be injecting themselves in. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong what they believe. What I'm saying is that is what they believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so the second problem you have is there is not a standing military. So there isn't, it's not like Germany where we could bomb Germany and carpet bomb their cities until their government came and admitted defeat and said, please make the bombing stop. It's not a war on nation against nation where the vast majority of the people who are engaged in that war are simply members of a national armed forces.
Mm-hmm.
What you have in the Middle East is you have only the people who are there, the only people who are fighting are people who are fanatical about the cause, who are willing to die simply to say that they were part of it. And with the no standing military, there's no head of the snake to cut off. There's nobody to bring to the negotiating mm-hmm. table. Even when you talk about groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, the news media wants you to believe that that's like a solid group. It's a cohesive group. When in fact, that couldn't be any further from the truth. They're actually a collection of individual groups that coordinate together and sure. Align themselves together when it suits them and when it benefits them. And you're already seeing fracturing of that between Iraq and Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan versus ISIS in Syria and al-Nusra. There's all kinds of competing factions in there. If we actually took a look at the battle space, what you would find is it's almost so confusing that one could not fully wrap their head around it. And what our government is suggesting is what we need to do is we need to engage in that. We need mm-hmm. to inject ourselves into the middle of that. I think it's a very, very, very bad idea.
Yeah, because it's not like there's enough men, women, and children that you could kill that would even stop it. And it might even just, it makes the problem kind of worse anyway to do that.
What I would say is, and I alluded to it in my piece, I said there is a way to win. Kill every man, woman, and child there.
Uh-huh.
You know, wipe their entire people off the face of the earth. That you could technically win if you could do that. That is an end that I don't think any American, much less those in Congress who make the rules, would be willing to do.
Yeah.
Number one, I don't think it's moral or ethical to consider that as an option, as long as our, especially with our liberty not being directly threatened here at home. But that would be the only way that you could make an idea like that disappear. What I was suggesting in my piece was, let's try disengagement. For the last 12 to 14 years, we've tried engagement on various levels, either total engagement or partial engagement, mm-hmm. and neither one of those has led to the outcome that we desire. So let's try something just a little bit different. Let's try disengaging. Let's stop injecting ourselves both militarily and politically in matters of state and matters of foreign policy that have no real bearing on our own freedom and liberty, and see if that doesn't kind of quell and chop the legs out from under this violent idea mm-hmm. that's been spreading through the Middle East.
Well, don't you think, or I don't know, but part of the troubling part for me is the people's reactions. And of course, and I think you even noted, it's justifiable to say, all right, we want blood. We're going to react here. We need to. We've got to. And it's justifiable. And I agree with that. I think that is a reasonable sentiment. Maybe it's not a good strategy. But why would some of the either media and politicians have such a stance that are they just catering to that popular demand and that weakness or short-sightedness of human nature?
Well, I think the politicians are no different than anybody else. They're affected emotionally. They want to defend the country, mm-hmm. many of them. I think you've got other people like Lindsey Graham and John McCain who legitimately would love to see us in 15 different armed conflicts around the world because they make a great deal of money and they receive a great deal of support from people who make...
Are they aware of that, though? Do they know that in their own mind or not? Are the politicians like that... realize they're just doing this for this and that reason, or do you think they genuinely believe what the stuff they're saying?
In my opinion, men like Lindsey Graham and John McCain legitimately understand that what they're doing is that they are campaigning in a sense for a larger military industrial complex. And I try and stay away from those types of terms because mm-hmm. they have a very jaded history.
Yep.
But you do have a group of very large, powerful companies that make their money by us maintaining, you know, being constantly at war. And men like John McCain and Lindsey Graham receive a great deal of money from donors like that. And there's no possible way that they can look at the outcome of the decisions that they have made over the last 10 to 15 years and say that we are better and safer than we were before. They are advocating that position, in my opinion, because they financially benefit by doing so, not because it's in the best interest of America.
The other thing about it is you said something that I thought was really interesting about politicians. They are telling people what they should do or what should be done versus them doing it themselves. And you put a lot of emphasis on individuals doing what they think ought to be done versus, you know, these people, surrogates, essentially, or money.
Yeah, that's a very libertarian principle. It's a principle that says I am responsible for my life. And in the event that, so for example, let's use the war since we're talking about it. If America's liberty is not directly threatened, and what I mean by that is we don't have an army that's coming up against our borders and getting ready to assault America and deprive us of our Constitution, our life, liberty, and property, then we have no business engaging in foreign wars. That is a libertarian principle. Now, in my opinion, if that was the case, then we would have every right to engage our military in defense, but our military should maintain a defensive posture, not an offensive posture. And there's a great deal of people who will disagree with me on that. This is just my experience and my opinion being a libertarian. Now, outside of that, you may look at the atrocities that are happening in Syria and in northern Iraq, and you may say, this is a travesty.
Mm-hmm.
We ought to be doing something about that. And all I ask is that you say to yourself, why don't you replace we with I?
Uh-huh.
You see, there are people right now who have left their jobs, who have flown halfway across the world to fight alongside the Kurds to try and defeat this enemy. There are people who have given hundreds and thousands of dollars to support the war effort over there because they personally believe in it.
Uh-huh.
But what they're not doing is they're not asking someone else to go and fight on their behalf. They're not asking someone else to pay. Yeah. This goes to the refugee crisis as well. You know, if you think that the refugee crisis is such a big deal and that somebody ought to do something about it, why don't you do something about it? Why don't you offer to take in refugees into your home? Why don't you agree to be responsible for their care and for the, and for providing for them and helping them find jobs mm-hmm. and establish themselves here in America?
But you're not saying that facetiously. You're saying you no. actually can do that.
Yes, I'm saying that is absolutely something that you have a right and responsibility to do. What I have always said is, if I believe in something, if I really believe in it, then I have the responsibility, if not the obligation, to take action on my own, to do what I feel I can or to give what I feel I can, and to try and convince as many people as possible to mm-hmm. do the same thing. But what I don't have the right to do is, I don't have the right to go to someone else and say, I think this is important, so I'm going to make you give.
So you should do it.
Yeah. Yeah, so you should do it. That's something that, and that is a libertarian principle that says, I don't own you. I don't own your wealth. I don't have a right to tell you what to do with, you know, with yourself, with your body, with your money. Those are your decisions. And I can try and convince you that what I want to do or what I'm suggesting we do is the best possible outcome, but I can't compel you by force.
Right. Yeah, not to mention, rightly, it does, you know, the refugee thing is one, but as far as fighting an enemy, really the enemy we have isn't necessarily over there anyway. It's a good case to be made that the only enemies that we really have already are here. They're in this country.
And that is, you're exactly right. And so if we shift this idea and say, well, okay, well, where should we be, where should government, where should we as individuals be using our money and our resources? Well, in my opinion, we should be protecting our lives, our liberty, and our property here at home against those people who may already be here. With the refugee crisis, in my opinion, one of the things is there's no possible way you can vet refugees coming here to America. It's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always said, well, one of the main functions that I believe government is needed for is to protect the populace from things like, you know, foreign wars and foreign armies. Well, certainly an insurgency would be another thing that government would have a responsibility for. Mm-hmm. And if government cannot provide reasonable assurances that the people they're bringing here are not associated with the radical Islam that is and the radical violence that's happening overseas, then we have a responsibility not to bring those people here.
You say any of them.
Any of them. Yeah, that'd be correct.
My natural thought would not be to go that way. I find you compelling, however, but I don't know that much about it. But it would seem like statistically it wouldn't be that many. I don't know what the possible loophole is, but, you know, you think that bringing them over would lead to, you think they would just really take advantage of the loopholes there and the
No, I don't suggest that anyone we would bring over would even be a radical, you know, associated with radical Islam. That's not what I'm suggesting. Mine is more of a specific argument to what is the role and responsibility of government. And certainly one of the main responsibilities is protecting the population. And that is a role of government, in my opinion.
I understand that as a role, but help me understand, first of all, why they can't be vetted. Why is that not possible?
Well, mainly because how is it going to be done? So normally in America, we have, when you're born, you receive a social security number. Every time you're arrested, there's a database of that. There's a federal database that you can go to and you can look at and say, yeah, this guy's got felonies. He spent 10 years in prison for armed robbery. How do you do that in Syria? Unless a guy has come up on a terror watch list somewhere, and that would mean he would be some upper echelon terrorist,
right,
there's absolutely no way for you to vet him.
Well, so, but would that not be true about all refugees anywhere, or, you know, just, there's got to be some element of threat to any border, anything, any visas that we take from other countries, even through legitimate means, there's still some risk. So what makes you feel like what's the threshold of not acceptable risk that makes this different than other things?
Well, I don't necessarily think this is different than any other thing. I think if you have someone who, if you have a nation where you have someone who's coming here who can be vetted, then you make accommodations for that. So it not necessarily coming from Syria, or let's say that you've got someone coming from China or coming from Singapore mm-hmm. and they want to immigrate to this country, or Mexico. Well, certainly they have deeper databases where the government can provide a reasonable assurance that someone is not coming to the country to directly do us harm. And that term reasonable assurance is a vagary that I realize exists.
Yep.
Because it's impossible for the government to be 100% sure that somebody's not going to do something wrong. But I think that in the Syria case, there just isn't any way to provide any assurance. There is no way to vet.
Well, is there another acceptable or useful humanitarian thing? What, given any humanitarian or sympathy to these people, what do you think is a proper course of action for the Syrian people?
Well, a proper course of action is if you believe that we need to be doing something for you to write a check, for you to send money to an organization who's working over there, mm-hmm. or for you to become a member of an organization that goes there to help,
mm-hmm.
and for you to do everything that you can to try and support the people because you feel like it is a worthy and honorable and noble cause.
And you would say U.S. government has no... the proper thing for U.S. government to do would be absolutely nothing?
Yes.
Okay. That's interesting, but that's not anti. That's interesting because it's not anti-humanitarian or unloving or any of that stuff. It's actually putting responsibility where responsibility ought to be.
It puts responsibility on the individual. That's correct. And so it's not that we don't care about them. It's not that we want them to die in foreign countries and that we don't want to take them in.
Mm-hmm.
It's that I don't believe that I have a right to tell you that you have to give to bring a foreign national here. To provide for them. That to me is theft. That to me is a gross violation of your liberty and your property and your justly earned money.
So you use the term liberty to cut through, use it as your razor to cut through what ought to and ought not to be done, essentially.
Well, I believe that government exists for one of three purposes, for three purposes, to protect life, liberty, and property.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, government serves no purpose whatsoever. They should not be engaged at any level. And that is a very much a libertarian belief. And one of the things that you will notice is all of the major problems that we see both domestically and internationally come when government leaves its core role of providing for life, liberty, and property and starts applying what we would consider positive rights onto people. So you have a right to health care, or you have a right to protection here, or you have a right to a job or a minimum wage. All of that has negative consequences. Everybody wants to be charitable. Everybody wants to have that great feeling like they've done something nice for somebody else. But what you need to understand is when you're advocating for bringing people here from a foreign country, if that's what we're talking about the refugee issue, what you're advocating for is that somebody else pay to bring this third mm-hmm. party here so that you can feel good about your position on the whole thing. But I try and show people, listen, you're hurting the people that you're trying to help. This is not the best way to do it. And let me try and show you what I think is a better way.
Because we can, but I'm not saying missing from your point of view as well thought out and reasoned, but what I want to keep understanding and reminding is you're saying we both agree we want to help people get a good wage or do well with their family, and we want to help. Even you would say that you do want to help and have a heart for the Syrian people. I haven't heard you say that yet, but I'm assuming that you're saying even you personally have an opinion that is you want what would be good for those innocent people.
I do. Let me clarify.
And then how do we get? I'm not trying to paint you in the bad light. Yeah. I'm saying, but now that if we can agree on that, now we can discuss what would be the most simply effective way to do that, or most just the best way to do it.
One of the things I try and explain to people early on is, hey, we both want the same thing. Whether you're a progressive who wants to provide charity to people and believes we have a responsibility to help the poor, or whether you're a neoconservative who thinks that we need to defend the weak and helpless, I'm right there with you, brother. I want all of those things too. But I just believe that it's a personal responsibility issue. It's mm-hmm. not one where we can advocate and force someone else to provide that benefit. So yeah, I think that we're in absolute agreement that we want to try and help people who are in need.
You feel like you are effective and able to change people's point of view, or do you feel like you just wind up talking to the people that are in the liberty camp?
No, I have made great strides to try and convince and to try and move outside of just the libertarian camp. Mm-hmm. Because it's very easy when you talk to just libertarians that they all get it. It's like, yeah, you know, don't take my stuff. Don't hurt people. That, yeah, we all agree on that. I have five principles that I kind of wrap my life around and my show around. And the five principles are limited government, peace, tolerance, individualism, and free markets. Mm-hmm. And I say those are the things that I believe in. I would challenge your audience to take those principles away and see if they can't reaffirm their own belief system around it.
Yeah, and those principles to you have led you to the following conclusions. Number one, disengagement militarily. And then also responsibility not to act or take in refugees. So that's kind of nuanced because the polarities go yes to both or no to both kind of thing. So that's what I think is interesting about it. It must be of your principles and reason that got you to that one. But have I got you right there? Disengagement military, and as far as bringing refugees to this country, no.
Well, yeah, I think that's that is a fair assessment. I think the caveat I would make is that I am I'm not opposed to refugees coming to America as long mm-hmm. as the government can provide reasonable assurances. And I'm not entirely sure that disengagement will work.
Right.
I'm just simply looking at it and saying, hey, we've tried engagement on one level or another for the past 12 years, and it's been an utter failure. How about we try something different? So we try a peace approach rather than a violence and war approach. And so I don't claim to suggest to you that that would work. I'm just saying, let's try something different and see.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I recommend people to go read the thing that you wrote. It's on the Paris attacks episode of your podcast. It's the Jason Stapleton Show, and I'm sure you can find you online anywhere as Jason Stapleton. I'll be listening to you in the future, and I appreciate your time today, Jason. Thank you.
And thank you for having me.
All right, Jason Stapleton. So next up, I wanted to get into and try to understand why people react as much and as strongly and get so heated about this and so opinionated, and how to cut through that a little bit. So I thought I'd get in touch with our buddy Science Mike, and we could just, you know, do what we do together and talk about these things, the brain, psychology, human behavior a little bit as it relates to this matter. So here we go, Science Mike. First of all, I was just curious what your point of view on terrorism and refugees are in a general way, and then specifically, why are we being all the people here in America and on social media, behaving the way that we're behaving? What do you think about all that?
In general, I would say, one, it is dangerous when human belief systems place a greater value on death than life. Anytime you can convince a human brain that their death has meaning, they become willing to sacrifice their lives, and it changes the, you know, neuroethics of how we make decisions.
I see.
And I even get nervous when I hear Christians saying how willingly they would die for their faith. On one level, there is some nobility to that idea, I guess. I just also understand how easy beliefs like that can be hijacked.
So that's super radical thing, when you have something super radical like death being the primary thing or not. I mean, the whole human brain is designed to operate within the construct of death being avoided, right? So if you flip that, it's weird consequences, perhaps.
Totally. Yeah. You can imagine that whether you're a creationist or an evolutionist, we've been shaped so that in most circumstances, we want to preserve our lives. But if we get our back against the wall and our lineage is threatened, our tribe, our children, our relatives' children, that we've been designed in such a way that we can desire our own death if we think it preserves our tribe.
I see.
And that's what's happening with terrorism, is those instincts are being hijacked and weaponized.
And so you feel like a lot of those people are even preyed on, or the terrorists genuinely believe it. That's one of the scary things, is they believe that what they're doing is right or good or positive. They're not just simply trying to be evil or bad.
Yes, and you'll also notice typically suicide bombers and people who carry out terrorist attacks are not studied religious folk.
Uh-huh.
They tend to be radicalized from a state of, you know, either a very casual faith or no faith at all. They're often recent converts. And so it seems that longer study, more in-depth study, a more scholarly approach to faith tends to inoculate someone against this to some degree. What you'll see a lot of times is people have lived in Western countries, grown up in Western culture, and then they see what things are like in either where they were born or their family's country of origin, and they're radicalized, and new ideas are put into their head, and typically they face some kind of either obliquely or overtly racist or ethnocentric environment where in some way they the color of their skin or their family's belief system has been limiting to them, and suddenly they find a lot of acceptance, a lot of encouragement, and they're told that if you do this, you know, you get X number of virgins on the other side, or your family gets glory in such a way, and in a very planned series of progressions, they're turned into weapons.
Yeah.
So it's really, really terrifying stuff. Now, on the refugee side,
well, let's just stay there if you don't mind. I'm interested in that. So if that's the case, though, then these people being terrorists, I'll only say that, are to be feared. We should be scared of them, I assume. So now
it is reasonable to fear them.
It is reasonable to fear them, period. And then it's a matter of there's a lot of other stuff to parse out and to sort through. But, you know, so it's not that crazy that people – I feel like it's crazy when I see stuff on social media, people I went to high school with, people that I'm not trying to say they're ignorant or dumb, but I go, wow, that's incredible, the kind of reactions that you would have, but they're kind of based, maybe rightly, somewhat in fear. So what's wrong with that? Are we not controlling our fear well, or as a group?
Well, here's what happens to a brain in fear. That's centered in something called your amygdala. That's an almond-shaped organ that's in two halves on either side of the brain that controls fear and anger. And when you get into a chronically or perpetually fearful state where your amygdala is in a near-constant state of arousal, it changes the way that you evaluate the world. And one of the
most... So too much Fox News will do that to you.
Too much CNN, too much MSNBC to you. But what happens, and this is telling, this will explain a lot about both sides of this issue in America. When you get into a perpetual state of amygdala arousal, be that fear or anger, your brain starts to exhibit higher degrees of in-group, out-group bias.
Yep.
Meaning you become more xenophobic or hostile towards people as you identify as being part of a different group than yourself. In the case of progressives, they become very hostile towards American conservatives. In the case of conservatives, they become hostile both towards American progressives and towards other people groups. But because, again, when I talk about labeling, neurocognition, part of progressive values is to be open to different cultures, different experiences, and different people groups, which is why, even as they entrench, they remain open to what they see as their tribe. But it's not that they're in some way morally or ethically superior to conservatives. It's simply that their labels cause the brain to function different in terms of identifying in-group and out-group.
So do you think we can tell the difference, or is it worth sorting out the difference in what we see from reactions from people that are fear or hate?
They're going to do the same thing to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Fear, hate, anger, they're all going to cause this ongoing state of amygdala arousal, and that's going to subvert the functioning of the prefrontal cortex to have rational decision-making, intentional focus, and to accept new information. When your amygdala is activated, you are trying to hold the line or win an argument, and that's it.
Yeah, that's just survival in a sense, and then just have this really weird avenue to debate and see it online that we maybe haven't really seen before. And I noticed that, like, I was I was on the road last week or 2 weeks ago whenever the Paris attacks happened and stuff, and my wife talked to me and she said, well, this is scary, this is dangerous, and she was talking about when I get home, she says, we're gonna have to really be careful, she said. And so I want to talk about what that would even mean, because when she said that, I was like, well, what do you mean be careful? I mean, this was a rock club in a city. Like, the terrorists, the attacks and stuff that they have, first of all, are statistically, to me, very — I'm not trying to be hyper rational here, but they almost never happen in a way.
You're absolutely correct.
And if they do happen, the only point of them is them happening in an unexpected way, in an unexpected place that certainly, you know, other care doesn't even seem to do anything. So I really feel like I want to say, well, I guess just don't worry about it then, because it could only be something. First of all, it's not likely to happen, even if we knew there was 20 terrorist attacks in the country, still, that still is terrible for our country, but not likely to happen. There's nothing I could think we could do behavior-wise that I could suggest to her that would make us even a lick more safe. And really, I don't even feel like we're in danger.
If you want to be safe in life, if you want to do some rational fears, drive fewer miles per year in an automobile.
Right.
Exercise more regularly, limit fat intake in your diet. Those are the killers of human beings and Americans today.
Absolutely.
Mass shootings, acts of terror, even homicide are not statistically significant things to fear. Now, that doesn't mean that those things aren't travesties that we should be working to eliminate from society. Don't misunderstand me. But for people to expend so much personal energy being fearful of their own life in the context of those situations is actually irrational.
Sure. I mean, even police violence is probably more likely going to get us than terrorist violence, right? I don't know the numbers on it, but... You know.
Statistically, in America, yeah, police violence would be a bigger risk to your life, right, frankly, especially if you're not white, than terrorism violence, for sure.
You were in London? Or you say you're over?
We were in London when the Paris attacks
happened.
Oh,
you were? I didn't know that.
Yeah, so in East London, in a very Muslim neighborhood, and I didn't feel unsafe at all.
A lot of people would have, though. I mean, I would say most people would have been really nervous about the people with those head coverings. I mean, that alone would probably freak a lot of people out. They'd be very uneasy there.
I made an extra effort to strike up conversations, mm-hmm. to get to know people. In London, a day before we were on one tube line, a man pushed a Muslim woman into the train. And so I wanted to do whatever small part I could to better represent the West to those people in London.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the thing. You know, I think we all agree terrorism is bad.
Sure. And scary. I think, and worthy to be scared of.
Everyone should fear that. What we need to understand is I think science is pretty clear on how you deal with terrorism. And that is, you educate and economically empower people, especially women.
Uh-huh.
Because remember, I said, in order to weaponize this neurocognitive lever of a martyr's death, of a meaningful death, someone has to be convinced that they and their tribe have their back against the wall,
right.
And there aren't any other options, which is why you don't see the same kind of radicalization in Christianity, because generally Christians are economically prosperous in the modern world.
Right.
And it's just, this is the fire hose that goes against the fire that's happening in Syria. Now, right now in Syria, the conflict has devolved to the point that you can't possibly come in with economic or education solutions.
And it's not immediate. You know, it's not near as immediate as bombs and bullets and kind of thing. But I mean, that kind of seems like the problem with it is, even if you're prone to or willing to combat that thing, the scary thing, the bad thing, terrorism, it's not easy to do, because it's really just a concept and an idea that you're fighting more than an individual or a group or a nation state. I would maybe liken fighting terrorism to fighting racism. It's bad. It's a problem. It's something that you should stop. And if the atrocities happen in its name, you say, well, we got to get them. But who is them, and how do you get them? Kind of thing. You can get the individuals, of course, but the problem of terrorism is much like the problem of racism. It's one of just beliefs and of ignorance and of or intolerance. So they're vague things that we have to battle, and they're not things that you could just necessarily overcome with power or force. So that's the part.
Terrorism and racism are both ideological problems, certainly. I think the difference is terrorism is a reaction to groups that feel powerless, and racism tends to be a collection of unthinking or intentional biases by groups that have the most power.
Mm-hmm.
So they're similarly dangerous and insidious, but they have kind of opposite social power dynamics.
But either way, wouldn't you say that the best weapons against them would be cognitive then?
Absolutely, yeah.
And not, you know, physical force.
Yeah, you, well, yeah, it wouldn't work. You couldn't, I don't think, in either case. I mean, you have to use the force you need to keep society safe,
sure.
Although that is something I struggle with all the time.
Well, we'll get there next with the refugees. That's an out thing of that. But yeah, I mean, you have to keep people safe, for sure.
Yeah, but in general, it's education and personal experiences are mm-hmm. going to turn those things around.
So to the matter of keeping people safe, then we shouldn't let any refugees in the country then, right?
We should let in as many refugees as we possibly can to keep our children safe.
Okay. Let me convince me of that one.
When we don't let refugees in, or we let them in and we, you know, put them in some kind of extremely limited camp situation or ghettos or what have you, you are creating the soil to deny or restrict education and economic power empowerment generationally, and therefore you are engineering more terrorists in the future. So limiting refugees might be statistically safer in the very near term, like months of time, but in the years and decades timeline, it is much more dangerous to a civilization to try to keep out these people that we view as scary. The fact is, if you look at American history, and in most countries, allowing refugees into a country has not generally turned out to be a bad thing for that country. Mm-hmm. So what I'd like to see is not only let the refugees in, but bring them into the culture, bring them into the job market, bring them in as consumers, make them a part of the American economy, uh-huh. and then they become very difficult to radicalize
right.
because they have something to lose.
Yeah. And yeah, I suppose I see what you're saying there. So, but you're accepting some amount of risk that unvetted refugees could be masquerading terrorists?
I think some inevitably will be.
Okay.
But you, those people are going to find a way to strike the United States anyway.
Mm-hmm.
If we fall into the fear-based ideology of keeping people out, or, you know, judging a large people group based on the nefarious actions of a few, we lose.
So having more of the Syrians or even Muslims or even anybody, even semi-radical, anything but radical Muslims in our country, on enough, if there was enough number and scale, we would less identify each other as the other.
I would love personally to have Syrian refugees over to my house,
yep.
and I would love personally to hire them to work with me.
Now, do you think that's the government's responsibility, or there's more individual stuff that we should be doing in order to achieve that?
I mean, I'm the guy. I don't care who does it. I just want it to get done.
Mm-hmm.
Is it people? I don't care. I mean, the government's the one that'll have to open access to the country and vet people. People do need to be vetted, of course. We already have excellent, you know, there's nobody more vetted than refugees entering the United States.
Uh-huh.
Nobody. People coming on a visa are less vetted than a refugee. But, you know, and they probably need some assistance out of the gate. They're going to go with no currency. I mean, these are people. Imagine if in your home city it had been leveled by civil war, your home was gone, everything you had was destroyed, and you were literally a podcaster or a shopkeeper or a teacher before this happened.
Mm-hmm.
You've never been in any military conflict, and someone let you into a country and then just kind of put you in a camp and said, okay, here you go, or worse, just set you and your family on the street and said, well, good luck. That creates that soil for radicalization, because these are people going to struggle and be on the edge of poverty.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do think this, and again, I'm speaking completely pragmatically. I don't care about the larger issue of big government versus small government. I'm saying in terms of limiting future radicalization and terrorists that will use their own lives as weapons, the best thing to do is bring people in and help them find economic security, which, by the way, a lot of the people have valuable job skills we need anyway. So sure. Some way to connect them with opportunities is going to be helpful as well.
Well, at this point, I'm still confused on the vetting because I talked to somebody else that says vetting's almost impossible with the records and this and that or whatever. So that's the kind of stuff I'm trying to sort through. But certainly, I agree with what you're saying in general, and it's... You know, it's the way that we I think there's a lot of it just to be pragmatic and to use your mind and logic to sort through it. So, because I see things that seem illogical to me from, of course, the terrorist side to my wife. And then a lot of people I went to high school with and people in the Bad Christian Facebook group. And I mean, there's tons of people. And I just look at every one of them and go, well, that doesn't. I'm almost nothing I'm hearing from any side seems to make a ton of sense. So it's a pretty confusing issue, at least, don't you think?
I will say it is so immensely complex that I don't like blame people for having a hard time clearly articulating their position. I still feel more lost than not, especially if I try to figure out who's at fault here or who needs to be punished or whatever. That's why I have to retreat, look at it more in the way we understand through science how human beings behave, and then if I start with a clean slate, how would I engineer a solution to a neurocognitive problem? Mm-hmm. And I understand also that kind of thinking is the most expensive thinking human brains can do. It uses the most calories, consumes the most oxygen, and that our brains are biased against it. So I don't blame people for using the neuro shortcuts of social identity and emotions to arrive at their decisions.
Well, to some degree, you feel like you want to combat things that seem like hate online, right?
Oh.
Or you think leaving that be is okay, too?
I'm not an online warrior.
Yeah.
I just don't do it.
Yeah,
people that are ready to have interesting, salient, coherent discussions, I'm there. As soon as it turns into, somebody wants to fight, I say peace be with you.
And then the other side I would push from on the other of the end of that is I sure do have a lot of like liberal warrior, anti-hate friends too that I feel like, man, I don't guess anybody's going to listen to you. Or you sound self-important and self-righteous in your love and what you think is the right answer or the good thing to do, but I don't know if I totally buy that from those people, and I feel like they're just speaking to their own people, reinforcing their biases against the other that might be,
that's human nature.
Yeah,
it's human nature, and I don't fault people for it, but I spent too long in advertising. I'm not going to say something unless it's going to land with somebody.
Right.
And so I am very intentional in how I use language to keep people's amygdalas asleep so we can have a discussion that might actually result in changed views. But by appealing to the lower brain, it hijacks the higher brain. So if you present information to someone or ideas in a story form, 6 to 8 weeks later, they're going to repeat that information, and they're going to say it like it's their own idea. Mm-hmm. They won't even remember they got it from this story.
Yeah.
You're literally taking someone from one point of view and setting them in another point of view through a narrative view temporarily.
Yeah.
Once they come back to their own view, they bring some of those feelings and some of those ideas with them unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
And so for communicators, that's a fantastic tool, which, even when I'm doing more, more brainy stuff, like on the Liturgist podcast, I still tend to insert a lot of personal stories and other kind of content that helps people get out of their own reference frame.
Yep, certainly a weakness of mine. I want to just tell people stuff. That's my default mode. I just want to tell you a whole bunch of stuff, and then you have to hear it, and then you can't disagree after you hear it, right? That's typically the way I like to...
The most powerful way to communicate is to tell a story and include the stuff.
Yeah.
That's what drives behavioral change more than anything. In one study, they told... they presented the facts and figures of smoking. They told the story of a son who lost his father to lung cancer. And then to a third group, they included the facts and figures in a story of a son who lost his father to lung cancer. And that third group exhibited the highest behavioral change over a 12-month period.
Yeah.
Well, I shouldn't have had you on. I should have found a refugee.
That's exactly right.
Well, Mike, I appreciate the point of view today. Thank you for helping me think through this a little bit.
Oh, man, thanks for having me on.
Right on. Okay, so Science Mike, brilliant as always, really fun to talk to. And so now at this point, after I spoke with him, I really felt like what was missing, especially after talking to Science Mike, was something personal, a personal story, a personal connection, something that was real and not just theoretical. And I realized after I got off with him that, I know people that are connected to this, and that's the Under Oath guys and people that knew the guy Nick who was killed. So the reason that this is really sticks out to me or is profound is because we tour Europe. We're over there a lot in these same kinds of clubs. We've been there with Under Oath, in fact. We have people over there that work for us. There's a guy named Patrick who's from the Czech Republic who drives our van, tour manages us, texts for us whenever we are in Europe. And so this is essentially the equivalent of our European crew member, Patrick, being killed. This is Chris Dudley from Under Oath, and he was friends with and knew on a real level somebody that worked for them that was, you know, murdered by terrorists. It's just too hard to even imagine what that is. And so I really wanted to talk to Chris. He's easy to talk to, a really gentle guy, and I'm just kind of really curious to as how he would react, or would he be altered or changed, or how would this color his thinking on the matter to be affected directly. So here we go. Last one. This is Chris Dudley from Under Oath.
He definitely was one of the victims there. And
how long was that after it went? I mean, how long after it happened did you find out that it was him and then that he had died?
Yeah, I want to say it was probably about, it was a matter of hours. You know, I'm saying mm-hmm. probably a matter of 4 to 6 hours from the time that I heard about it to when word got to us that that he had been involved in it. It's crazy because, like, I've never had anyone even remotely close to me involved in anything like that. Like, you know, mm-hmm. I have friends that had family members that were affected by 9/11 personally and that sort of stuff. But I had never really been affected personally by anything like this. So it's obviously completely foreign to me.
But tell me about Nick. What did he do for you and how much did you know him?
Yeah, he was our merch guy when we would go over to Europe. And I don't know specifically how many tours he did with us, but it was just one of those things. Whenever we went to Europe, Nick was on the bus. You know, mm-hmm. I know you guys have a guy like that as well. And it's crazy. Like, we knew him really well. Like, you know how it is being on tour. Like, you just see someone all day, every day. You're living in a metal tube with them for weeks at a time. Like, you know, we would be up late having, you know, late night bus talks and just, you know, dudes.
What nationality was he? He spoke English first language?
Yeah. He was, I think he was from the UK somewhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know specifically what city he was from, but he was a Briton and, just a great dude, like really good person to be around. Like, he just had a really good vibe. Like, when you're around him, you're just like, man, like, I would just want to be around this guy more.
Yeah. Well, he must have been. He must have done a good job and been super solid. He worked for Panic the Disco and Alice in Chains and, you know, you guys and everybody else. I'm trying to remember. Is it possible that he was on tour, that I've met the guy? Was he on tour with us when we were in Europe together? Would he have been with you guys then?
Man, honestly, I'm not sure. Like, I'm the worst at that sort of thing because a lot of that stuff just kind of is a blur to me as far as what bands and what cities. And yeah, there's a good chance, though. I mean, you know, most of the time when we were in Europe, he was with us. So he was a great guy, man. Really, really great guy.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that. I know that's personally, I know, you know, affected you guys for sure. It's really hard to imagine. I guess the closest thing to it is there's been some guys in bands that we've known have died. So Beats from Bayside died driving down the highway where we all drive down on 80 in Wyoming. That was about 10 years ago. And then mm-hmm. Casey from Hawthorne Heights died. And that, you mm-hmm. know, that was the same kind of situation. Somebody we knew, we didn't know
beach, really, but Casey we knew real well. And he died in a tour bus a couple hours north of us from where we were playing that night. And those are big deals, but this is just weirder. This is different in the sense that the cause of it is it's murder. I mean, it's not the same thing as an accidental death or an accident at all.
Yeah.
So it's like totally off the charts of radar. What I really want to know how it has affected your thinking about the topic or about ISIS or about terrorism or about Islam even.
Yeah, like I was actually talking with my wife about this the other night, like just the state of things in the world and, you know, among that, you know, terrorism and, you know, a war that seems like it's been going on since I was a kid and is that shows really no signs of stopping at any point and all that stuff. And I don't know if it's simplistic or if it is bad, but like, it just, what happened to Nick really didn't change the way that I feel about a whole lot. Like, I'm still just like, man, this is ridiculous. Like, you know, I know that that all these topics are so complicated and it's not black and white, but there's some things that, you know, as a Christian, I view as black and white. You know, it's like, you know, we need to love, we need to not murder people and that sort of thing. And, you know, as far as terrorism goes, it's like, it's such a foreign concept to me. I cannot even grasp it.
So you don't, I mean, how about fuck ISIS though? Is that not an emotion you have?
Yeah, but it hasn't really changed now what I was feeling, you know, when I'm seeing these videos of them like beheading people. I'm just like, you know, what the hell are these people doing? Like, you know, it feels a lot closer to home, but my core feeling about it is still just like, just mind blown. Like I just cannot grasp any of that, you know? And I think so much of it, I think, gets distilled in the media down to, okay, well, you know, we have like a Muslim problem. And, you know, I have friends who are Muslim and I have spoken to them and they're just like, man, like we cannot catch a break, you know, like these are like good people and, you know, not crazy at all, you know, just legit human beings. And, you know, it's such a complicated topic because I've been like, hey, like, you know, it sucks for you guys because like every one of these people seems to be a Muslim and they're like, yeah, we know, but they're like extremists on a super far end. And I don't have like 100 Muslim friends. I have 2, but one of them was telling me, he's like, yeah, he's like, well, if you look back at like the Christian Crusades, he was like, if you lived at that point in time, you would view Christianity in a similar light because it would seem like all this bad stuff that was going on seemed to be traced back to Christianity. He was like, it's not what you hold as your core belief, but you know, you're being lumped in with all these other people. And, you know, but then I hear so many arguments on one side and the other, not necessarily about the Muslim issue, but about just, you know, refugees, war, terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. And there's so many arguments on so many different sides that seem to make sense. And I feel like
that religion itself is dangerous and fosters and, you know, bad ideas and extremism and that, you know, there's the notion that a good amount of non-extremist Muslims still, people would say, even understand or sympathize with ISIS, but maybe aren't as extreme, for instance. That kind of stuff, you mean?
Yeah, and I have not, like, read the Quran. I'm not educated in any of this stuff, and I'm just like, you know, so many times I just don't know what to think. Like, but I also feel like there's such an, like, I feel this across the board with a lot of things, but I feel like there's such an agenda as far as the media goes. Like, everyone's trying to push their narrative on what they want every event that happens to say. And I'm like, I really want to just be able to turn to like one information source and just be like, okay, what the hell's going on? You know?
Well, just, so when you found out that about Nick and the days after that or whatever, did, if you found that, if you found out or when you found out that, that France is going to close down the borders and then go do some attacking and bombing over there, how do you receive that?
Well, when I, cause I think it was directly after that, I think I had heard that it was it France or Russia that went and did bombing directly after that?
Yeah, they may both. I don't even, I actually don't even know the answer to that.
Yeah. But my immediate reaction was like, hell yeah. Like, you know, they, like, I had this like, this gut feeling of just like, yeah, those guys are getting it done. Like, you know, oh, you're going to do this. Okay. We know who ISIS took responsibility. So we are going to go and drop bombs, you know, but then after that, I went and I did some reading and I was looking at, okay, you know, exactly what was done by who. It's, yeah, man, I don't know. And then, you know, you have all the whole thing with the Syrian refugees and everything. Yep. And that's a whole topic that I think is just spewing out of all this other stuff. And I feel like there's just a whole lot of fear.
So you don't feel like you're getting any good information or still don't know what to think. And it also doesn't seem like you're overly colored by the personal connection to this.
Yeah. Part of me feels bad for that. Like, part of me feels like I should be like, they did this to my friend, so we need to nuke somebody.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like I should feel that, but I don't. Like, I feel like I know, like, the Syrian refugee thing is kind of bleeding into this because there was reports that one or two of the attackers had posed as Syrian refugees going into France, and that's how they got in. And, you know, I know people are like, well, hell, like, shut down the border.
Right.
And even though I have this, like, personal connection to what happened, like, in this, with this topic in particular, with the refugees, like, I don't feel that way.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I mean, and you're maybe a little bit of a different kind of guy, Chris. You are what is known as a really nice guy and an empathetic guy and a caring guy. So I wouldn't be surprised to hear that you were, in the general way, pro-refugee and anti-violence. That would be consistent with what I would say is your general character. However, how interesting is it that somebody potentially crossed a border as a Syrian refugee and murdered one of your friends, and now they're talking about bringing Syrian refugees over to this country where you're going to go play rock shows and have a merch guy and do all those same things, and you're saying that you're still sympathetic to the refugees coming into this country? I mean, it'd be very reasonable for you not to be.
Yeah, like, the way I look at it is, from what I know, you know, the amount of innocent people who are legitimately fleeing terrorism, like, they are trying to get away from the exact thing that we're trying to fight, and they're trying to find somewhere to go. And you kind of look at it as a risk versus reward sort of thing. Like, I heard somebody talking the other day, and they were just saying, like, you know, we take risks every day with our living and everything we do, from, you know, from driving a car to swimming to, you know, doing anything we do, there's an amount of risk involved. But you have to weigh that with, you know, what good can come of what it is that you're doing.
And yeah, that's a good point, because if you're saying is the very thing that we're afraid of that would make us take some preventative action is the very thing that there are, I don't know, tens or hundreds of thousands of people that are in absolutely direct threat of right now. And
yes,
if we do bring them over, we're still individually not really threatened. I mean, there's potential and there's risk, of course. But if you do the risk-reward calculation, I think you're right. No matter what, the benefit to those people, even 5 of them, even 100 of them, is profound benefit, guaranteed benefit. Whereas there's just a theoretical, mathematical risk to any of us, and certainly not any direct threat to anybody. You know, the worst-case scenario would be pretty bad for those that would be affected, but there's not a high chance that something bad would happen to us, but there's a, you know, a 100% chance that these other individuals that are legitimately fleeing would be benefited greatly.
Yeah.
So then it's just saying who's more important, me or them, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the fact that France, from what I understand, is still... they're still going to be accepting the refugees that they had agreed to accept is, I think that speaks volumes, you know, like that's not, you know, they're not doing that from a biblical, you know, Christ-centered, viewpoint. I don't think they're just doing it as a, hey, like, there are these people who are not far from our country that are like right here, mm-hmm. just really wanting to come in and survive. And even though there
even
were
though
these,
they just had an attack directly.
Yes. Yeah. And they're saying, hey, even though there's these 4 people who did atrocious things, we can't leave these other people just out to dry.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, I don't.
So that makes the us then, or the thread of Americans that have an even more obstinate point of view start to seem really jerky or xenophobic or racist, right? I mean, are you seeing the stuff? I guess what I'm saying is I intend to agree with you on most of your impulses, and I also don't have very good information, but my impulses are along the lines of yours, but I'm trying to check myself, so I figured, man, maybe if I talk to somebody who knows somebody killed by the terrorists, then at least they would have the opposite point of view than me, and I could, like, somebody that I trust or could learn from. But even hearing you say that, yeah, that sounds even more and more like still what I think. If that's not presumptuous, so then I'm thinking, so how do you then take the stuff that you inevitably must be seeing in your Facebook feed, or the anti-Syrian or refugee or Muslim, or the, you know, the stuff you must see from the, you know, maybe people you went to high school with and stuff like that?
There's so much of the quote-unquote national debate that goes on, but it's just in internet comments.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, they'll call it a dialogue or whatever, but it's really just a lot of people yelling a viewpoint and just knowing 100% that they're correct and everyone else is
wrong.
Well,
is there a viewpoint, Chris, out of anybody's out there that does irritate you, or you don't get irritated that easily? I know that, so I'm kind of pressing for it. But is there a point of view that does irritate you here?
I don't know. Like it's hard, because even the people that I would look at and say, man, I completely disagree with this guy. Like so many times, like Donald Trump, like, I mean, he's like the like hot button, like, hey, like, what do you think of Donald Trump? But like, there's a lot of times when he talks and I'm just like, man, like I would be so scared if this guy was in charge of our country. But even him, he'll say things and I'm like, yeah, he's got a point there.
Yeah.
Like, I think that I tend to look at everyone and say, okay, well, what is this person saying that I can agree with? And I just kind of tend to tune out the rest. Like, you know, I'll straight up like listen to like conservative talk radio, even like if the guy is just spewing nonsense that I completely disagree with, just because I'm like, oh, well, he might have something that I can latch on to. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, so I don't know. Like I, you know, when I hear politicians just straight up saying, "Hey, we need to close the border 100%," like I don't agree with that, but I also recognize that they're not being, I don't think they're not being like intentionally like cold about it. Mm-hmm. Like they're what
I mean,
they're
you're saying they might even have a point. They might even be right for all you know.
I'm saying that they do make valid points. Yeah. And I also think that they are genuinely looking out for the best interests of our country and their viewpoint. Like, I completely get why someone would say, hey, we need to completely shut the border down. It's like, yeah, you're saying that because you want to make sure that nothing like that happens here. You're saying that because you want to make sure that we are all protected and we are all safe. Like, I don't think they're doing that saying, like, yeah, like, you know, all the women and children that are trying to flee here, they can go burn. I don't care. They're saying, like, hey, like, sorry, but we're trying to protect the people here. I don't agree with it, but I also get where they're coming from. Like, mm-hmm. It's, man, it's just a, it's a, it's something that takes a lot of talking and a lot of working through and a lot of praying about and just freaking.
It might not be sortable, Chris. I mean, I've talked to four people now about this that I thought would have really good insight, and I still feel relatively confused on the matter. I think some stuff's become a little bit more clear in talking to mm-hmm. people. But how about this, Chris? Are you afraid? Will you be afraid playing shows, going to Europe, doing your daily life with your family?
I will not be afraid. I'll be aware. It's possible that something could happen, but at the end of the day, like, I would not let anything that happens, like anything that a terrorist is doing, change the way that I am choosing to live my life or my family live in their lives. Cause you know, it's super cliche, but it's like, once you start doing that, then that's the point that they're like, you know, they're getting exactly what they want.
Is that cliche? I mean, I was about to say, dude, you just stumbled onto something really cool there. Cause I think you're right. Maybe I'm cliche there, but yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That I think that's the interesting question is, will we be afraid going forward and what will we do? And if so, are they winning? Are they changing, you know, our life, or do we have the ability to move forward and do exactly what we're going to do otherwise?
I got forwarded this email the other day. Long story short, as I thought this email was coming from the security department in the company that I work for.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out it wasn't, but it was a forwarded email saying that all government buildings were being put on alert because there was like $30,000 worth of UPS uniforms that was bought illegally online, and they thought that terrorists had purchased these and they were going to be delivering packages to random places in the US and to be on alert and all this stuff. And when I got that email, it was really crazy because I was like, oh, the UPS guy's coming here today, you know? And there was kind of a little bit of that feeling that I think we all got on 9/11, where it's like, oh, wow, like, we're not completely safe here, you know? And I had talked to my wife about it because there was like 20 minutes there where we thought this was like legit. It ended up not being legit, but
it was for you at that moment.
Yeah, though. It was. And we were talking and we were like, man, like, you know, $30,000 worth of uniforms. You figure every uniform's probably costs about $8, like, you know, doing the numbers. And we're just, and within that 20 minutes, we had already come to a, we're going to live, we're going to raise our kids. Like, we're going to take care of us, you know, maybe go buy some bottled water just in case. But
oh, man. Well, you know, whoever's behind that is really kind of despicable, too. I mean, that's just somebody probably whipping up a chain email to create some fear. And that's not even terrorists. That's just like American buttholes probably doing that.
Yeah.
That's despicable.
And turns out that email's been going around since like 99.
Yeah. that is very funny. That is funny. Well, there's so many things here we can't control, but we can control what we do. So I do think one of my biggest takeaway must be that we still have a choice of how we behave for us. And I think the right thing to do is continue on and choose not to alter most of the things that we do, really.
Yeah,
I think that's the biggest thing that's really the only thing we can do, because even information is super hard to come by in a reliable way. So the only choice we have is to change a bunch of stuff, and you'll be guessing at, is this better or worse? Is this the good thing to do, the bad thing to do? Or just determine, I have the power here to take care of people logically, the way that I see fit, do everything I'm supposed to do humanitarian-wise, and you know, I'm going to live my life and move straight ahead. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to even overly worry, I guess, is probably a strong point of view, not a weak one, in my opinion.
Yeah, man. At the end of the day, it's like, you know, you can get as educated as you want, but, you know, I just want to make sure I'm raising my kids to be awesome and to be able to, you know, love people the way that they need to, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, that comes through clearly, and I think you're on the right track for that, Chris. And I appreciate your thoughts on it. And also, I'm really sorry to hear about Nick.
Oh, well, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, that's all I've got, Chris. I appreciate your time today.
All right. Good deal, man. Well, thanks for the call, man. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Chris.
That was Chris. That was my conversation for today. I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did. I really did like this format. It's a bit more work, but it's real satisfying to me. I feel like I learned some stuff, and I really hope you did too. And if there's other stuff you'd like to hear me explore, other subjects, maybe not so much politics, but anything else that would work in this format, let me know. I really enjoyed it. And I got to say thank you, just because I have an audience. I think I should be able to get, just because of an audience like you, I can just maybe bring up people and talk to real interesting people that I can learn from. So thanks again. I'll talk to you guys. I'll see you guys soon. Hang on 1 second. Hold on. Hey, Georgia, tell them see you later.
See you later.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, jabberjawmedia.com.
Shh.
That's what ransomware is all about. It's psychological pressure.
Ransomware, when your computer's hacked into and your data held ransom. Attacks are on the rise, and Russian gangs are making billions of dollars.
The moment I got that message, I knew our greatest fears that we ever have are starting to come true.
The post-Cold War era is over.
.com, the hacking. A new season from Crowd Network with me, Katie Puckrick. Just search for .com, that's .com, and subscribe.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.